Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. You can find me at ColleenPatrickGoudreau.com and on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And be sure to subscribe to Food for Thought at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying this free podcast called Food for Thought, I urge you to share it with others and please leave ratings and reviews. Word of mouth is the best way to increase its listenership, and supporting it is the best way to keep it going. You can go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau to leave a tip in the jar. Hi, everyone. I hope you're doing really well. As I record this podcast episode, I am preparing to leave in a few days for our third vegan CPG trip to Thailand. And I'm so excited to spend time with many of you who I have already traveled with to Italy. And some of you I've already seen at our Compassion conferences. And of course, we have other trips planned in the future. The one that's coming up that I hope you're all sending your deposit in for is our vegan Vietnam trip in 2018. You can go to cpgtrips.com. It's going to be a fabulous, fabulous trip, mostly to the northern part of Vietnam, where it is so absolutely gorgeous. We're obviously hitting a number of historic sites. Obviously, we've thought of all the food for you. And Vietnam is a little more challenging than, say, Thailand in terms of eating vegan, just in terms of fish and fish sauce and that kind of thing. But we are taking care of all of that for you. You can see the whole itinerary at cpgtrips.com. And you can also see the fact that we are going to Animals Asia's sanctuary for the moon bears in Vietnam. This sanctuary is not open to the public. You only get to go because you're traveling with us. We're staying in a private boat on Hai Long Bay. We are visiting, as I said, historic sites. It's an all-inclusive trip, and it is five-star accommodations, five-star transportation. And I'm really excited to see you there. So we're getting full, and I really encourage you to go to cpgtrips.com and make your deposit today so you don't miss out on this opportunity. So the conception for this particular episode was thus. I found this poem written by a well-known American poet about a horse, and I was going to share that with you. Then I discovered that that poem was made into a film by a humane education organization founded by an ordinary citizen who, after learning about animal abuse, decided to devote his life to abolishing cruelty to animals. At the same time, he was inspired by a best-selling novel written also by an ordinary citizen concerned about animal abuse. Said organization founder sponsored a writing contest for another work of fiction that would highlight animal cruelty for the public, which also became a bestseller. And it just got me really excited about sharing these connections with you to hopefully inspire you, who I assume, like me, is an ordinary citizen, to use your voice, to use your skills, to use your gifts, to raise awareness, to help animals, and inspire others. So here's how it all begins. There's an old story that has been told as a children's fable in Italy for a number of years, a didactic one at that, but for a good cause. It does appear that this story, this fable told in Italy, has historic roots. It appears that a bell of justice was hung by the Indian emperor, known simply by his imperial name of Jahangir, who lived from 1569 to 1627. He hung this bell of justice that anyone could ring to convene a judicial hearing of a grievance. One day, a starving horse rang that bell, and so we have our story that at some point made its way to Italy. Now, how long it's been told as a narrative, as a children's fable, I wasn't able to glean. But in 1863, American poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow memorialized this story in a poem called The Bell of Atri, which I've also seen called The Sicilian's Tale, The Bell of Atri, A-T-R-I. In the poem, the head of the town, Atri, in this case, is King John, or as Longfellow poetically calls him in one line, Ray Giovanni, King John. Now, a couple things to note about some words you may be unfamiliar with or take offense to in this poem. A syndic is a civil magistrate. Bryony is a type of vine. And the word dumb was used at the time to mean devoid of speech. It's an old English word going back before the year 1000 to mean mute or speechless. It didn't come to have the meaning of stupid until the 1700s. So when people refer to dumb animals, they're not saying stupid animals. They're saying animals with no speech or voice. It wasn't meant to be offensive to animals. So here is The Belle of Autry by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, composed in 1863. And then we're going to get to some really wonderful connections between this poem and animal advocacy. At Autry in Abruzzo, a small town of ancient Roman date but scant renown, one of those little places that have run half up the hill beneath a blazing sun and then sat down to rest as if to say, I climb no farther upward, come what may. The Ray Giovanni, now unknown to fame, so many monarchs since have borne the name, had a great bell hung in the marketplace beneath a roof projecting some small space, by way of shelter from the sun and rain. Then rode he through the streets with all his train, and with the blast of trumpets loud and long, made proclamation that whenever wrong was done to any man, he should but ring the great bell in the square, and he, the king, would cause the syndic to decide thereon. Such was the proclamation of King John. How swift the happy days in Autry sped. What wrongs were righted need not here be said. Suffice it that, as all things must decay, the hempen rope at length was worn away. Unraveled at the end and strand by strand, loosened and wasted in the ringer's hand. Till one who noted this in passing by mended the rope with braids of bryony, so that the leaves and tendrils of the vine hung like a votive garland at a shrine. By chance it happened that in Autry dwelt a knight with spur on heel and sword in belt, who loved to hunt the wild boar in the woods, who loved his falcons with their crimson hoods, who loved his hounds and horses and all sports and prodigalities of camps and courts, loved or had loved them, for at last grown old, his only passion was for the love of gold. He sold his horses, sold his hawks and hounds, rented his vineyards and his garden grounds, kept but one steed, his favorite steed of all, to starve and shiver in a naked stall, and day by day sat brooding in his chair, devising plans how best to hoard and spare. At length he said, what is the use or need to keep at my own cost this lazy steed, eating his head off in my stables here, when rents are low and provender is dear? Let him go feed upon the public ways. I want him only for the holidays. So the old steed was turned into the heat of the long, lonely, silent, shadeless street, and wandered in suburban lanes forlorn, barked at by dogs and torn by briar and thorn. One afternoon, as in that sultry clime, it is the custom in the summertime, with bolted doors and window shutters closed, the inhabitants of Autry slept or dozed. When suddenly upon their senses fell the loud alarum of the accusing bell, the syndic started from his deep repose, turned on his couch and listened, and then rose and donned his robes and with reluctant pace went panting forth to the marketplace, where the great bell upon its crossbeam swung, reiterating with persistent tongue in half-articulate jargon the old song, someone hath done a wrong, hath done a wrong. But ere he reached the belfry's light arcade, he saw, or thought he saw, beneath its shade, no shape of human form, of woman born, but a poor steed, dejected and forlorn, who with uplifted head and eager eye was tugging at the vines of bryony. Domenedio, cried the syndic straight, this is the knight of Atri's steed of state. He calls for justice, being sore distressed, and pleads his cause as loudly as the best. Meanwhile, from street and lane, a noisy crowd had rolled together like a summer cloud and told the story of the wretched beast in 25 different ways at least, with much gesticulation and appeal to heathen gods in their excessive zeal. The knight was called and questioned, in reply did not confess the fact, did not deny, treated the matter as a pleasant jest, and set at naught the syndic and the rest, maintaining in an angry undertone that he should do what pleased him with his own. And thereupon the syndic gravely read the proclamation of the king, then said, "Pride goeth forth on horseback grand and gay, but cometh back on foot and begs its way. Fame is the fragrance of heroic deeds, of flowers, of chivalry, and not of weeds. These are familiar proverbs, but I fear they never yet have reached your knightly ear. What fair renown, what honor, what repute can come to you from starving this poor brute? He who serves well and speaks not merits more than they who clamor loudest at the door. Therefore the law decrees that as this steed served you in youth, henceforth you shall take heed to comfort his old age, and to provide shelter in stall, and food and field beside." The knight withdrew abashed. The people all led home the steed in triumph to his stall. The king heard and approved, and laughed in glee, and cried aloud, "Right well it pleaseth me. Church bells at best but ring us to the door. But go not into mass, my bell doth more. It cometh into court and pleads the cause of creatures dumb and unknown to the laws, and this shall make in every Christian clime the bell of Atri famous for all time." So that was Longfellow's poem published in 1863 about a starving horse who rings the bell of justice and is given justice by the magistrates and the king. And coincidentally, that's the same year, 1863, that Henry Bergh was appointed to a diplomatic position in Russia by President Lincoln, and on his travels around Europe saw so much animal abuse that he decided to give up a prestigious diplomatic career in order to work on behalf of mercy and justice for animals. Henry Bergh came back to the United States and founded the ASPCA, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, in 1866, which we talked about in the Food for Thought episode in which I chatted with Animal League Defense Fund's executive director, Stephen Wells, about animals and the law. I mentioned Henry Bergh in that episode. So Henry Bergh founded the ASPCA in New York City in 1866, and that was the same year that another gentleman who was to change the course of the plight of animals in the U.S. had his own life-changing experience with animal abuse. In 1866, the same year Henry Bergh founded the ASPCA, Massachusetts-born George Thorndike Angel, that's Angel with two L's, attended horse races and witnessed horses cruelly being run literally to death during a brutal 40-mile race. The horses died by the end. And disgusted and motivated by what he saw, and inspired by the work of Henry Bergh in New York City, Angel decided to dedicate his life to abolishing cruelty to animals. And so in 1868, he founded the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the MSPCA, establishing the second animal protection organization in the United States. Just 3 years later, after he established the MSPCA, 24 cities across the U.S. had established similar animal protection organizations. Angel also established a publication called Our Dumb Animals, for which he became editor. And this publication, Our Dumb Animals, factors into our story, as you will see, and reminds us of what I said earlier. The title wasn't meant to be condescending or insulting to animals, as it sounds now to our modern ears. Dumb animals was a common phrase referring to animals in general who have no speech. Now, of course, today we would say that they indeed have language and speech and culture, but it was an expression of its time. Angel created this journal to promote the humane treatment of animals. But that's not all. In 1882, Angel, along with Reverend Thomas Timmons, began the formation of the Bands of Mercy, which were formal, locally led organizations that brought people together for the promotion of kindness to animals through humane education. And then in 1889, Angel founded the American Humane Education Society, which brings us back to the Belle of Atri. In 1920, the American Humane Education Society that Angel founded in 1889, this organization turned Longfellow's poem into a film that was screened publicly for the first time on October 16th, 1920. Now, according to the National Museum of Animals and Society, which is now called the Animals Museum, the decision to turn this tale into a film appears to have been discussed by the AHES, the American Humane Education Society, as early as March 1916. At that time, the president, Dr. Francis Rowley, appealed to readers of Our Dumb Animals for financial assistance for the production of a film, stating that this project, quote, promises to be a production of very high order. Unless all indications fail, it will be shown all over the United States and abroad as well. Its fundamental purpose is to awaken and foster the principles beneath all humane education. Its appeal is to old and young alike. This is in 1916, talking about a film about animal abuse that they want to create and make and produce, and they're raising funds for, to raise awareness to the public about cruelty to animals. And it reminds me of a Kickstarter we would have today for an animal protection film. But it was just good old-fashioned fundraising to their audience, and the funds for the project were received. And for many years, the Belle of Atri was an important tool in the campaign for humane education. And the press published favorable reviews of the film, including this one from the Boston Globe in 1920. In its screen presentation, the beautiful poem is one to hold the attention of the spectators from start to finish. The pictured story of the aged horse, his ill treatment, and the method by which he won redress for his wrongs is finely presented. No little expense was incurred to secure such a beautiful picture, with its wonderful lesson in kindness to animals. And the part played by the horse in the film presentation shows careful training of the steed. The photoplay throughout is of the best, the scenes both pretty and dramatic. The spectators were generous in their applause of the fine points of the picture. And thank you to the National Museum of Animals and Society for preserving that story and that review. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find a copy of the film. So if anyone out there, and I've reached out to the Animals Museum, if anyone is aware of a copy anywhere of this film, please let me know. Now, this wasn't the first convergence of literature and art and advocacy to emerge. If we back up to the late 1800s, when George Thorndike Angel was still alive, and when concern for animals was picking up steam and people like Berg and Angel were doing their work, modeled after the pioneering work of animal protectionists in the UK, we can look at some other examples of art and literature and advocacy converging. Keep in mind that the animal protectionists that inspired the American protectionists like Angel and Berg, they were inspired by UK animal activists. The RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which we've talked about at different times in different podcast episodes, was founded in 1824. So we're now at the late 1800s where US activists are founding organizations. But U.S. advocates had a lot to look up to and a lot to model themselves after because of the work in the UK. So in the 1800s, animal abuse was on people's minds a lot because it was in full view, literally on the streets, every day, everywhere you turned, because animals, and especially horses, were the primary form of transportation. In fact, they were used in every way at that time in society. They were used in wars, in agriculture, in construction, in factory work. They pulled, they plowed, they hauled. They were seen as a measure of wealth and stature. And of course, all of this is a formula for abuse. So in 1877, A book was published by a writer whose sole intention was to raise awareness of the plight of these animals and to send a message to the public who might otherwise have been looking the other way from what was in full view. And I'm going to tell you about this book in just a moment, but first I really need to thank those who make this work possible, all of you who are listening and all of you who support this work. I cannot thank you enough. Everyone who supports this work at $5 a month, $10 a month, $30 a month. We have $100 a month supporters and $200 a month supporters making this work possible. Of course, our platinum supporters, Morgan Hall, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray, Michal Stone, Tim Anderson, Jennifer Ellis and Ben Ellis, Sylvie Raquel, Ulrich and Renee Marinkovich all make this work possible, as does every single one of you. And remember, supporters at $10 a month and above receive written transcripts for every Food for Thought episode and every Animology podcast episode. So if you're getting anything out of either podcast or my work in general, I'm leaving as soon as I finish recording this today to go record another radio editorial for National Public Radio, KQED, my local NPR station. So if you value this voice for animals, I encourage you to go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, or you can go to ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com and click on the donate button. And while you're there, make sure you check out other events happening, not only the Vietnam event coming up in 2018, but also some talks I have that I'm giving around the country. Your work also supports that. So as I said, in 1877, a book was published by a writer whose sole intention was to raise awareness of the plight of these animals and to send a message to the public about animal abuse. The full original title of this book was Black Beauty, His Grooms and Companions, The Autobiography of a Horse, translated from the original equine by Anna Sewell. That's the original title. Of course, today we just call it Black Beauty. And indeed, Anna Sewell was the voice for this horse who served as the ambassador for all those in his shoes. Sewell was a Quaker born in Yarmouth, England, who followed in the footsteps of her mother, Mary Wright Sewell, who wrote several popular books for children. But Anna did not intend for Black Beauty to be a book for children. She wanted to send a message to the adults who controlled the lives and the welfare of the horses they cared for. The decision to write the book as an animal autobiography was a novel decision at the time. There was nothing like that in Victoria, England, and it was released to great fanfare. Never before had a novel been written from an animal's point of view, and it was immediately embraced by the public. Within 2 years, 1 million copies of Black Beauty were in circulation in the U.S., and animal rights activists regularly passed copies of the book to horse drivers and stable hands. Sadly, Sewell never got to appreciate its immense success. She died just 5 months after the book was published in late 1877, but she had left her mark and had accomplished exactly what she had set out to do. Black Beauty was groundbreaking, and it changed the way horses were perceived and cared for. In fact, George Thorndike Angel had spent years searching for a book that would inspire people to treat animals humanely, much the way Uncle Tom's Cabin helped advance the abolitionist movement that eventually led to the ban on human slavery. And in 1890, someone brought Black Beauty to Angel's attention, and he knew it was the right book to further his cause. By the time he died in 1909, Angel had distributed around 2 million copies of the book to school children. To this day, Black Beauty is one of the most popular books in history, having sold more than 50 million copies in 50 languages. And just to give you an idea of other books in the 50 million range, you've got Lolita, Charlotte's Web, Anne of Green Gables, Watership Down. Now, what I love is that when you look at that short list of just a few books that were in the 50 million range, I just have to say that it's worth noting that Charlotte's Web continues to be used as an animal advocacy tool, as does Black Beauty. I think not as much as it used to be, but both of these books in the 50 million best-selling range are books about animals who are being exploited by humans. Watership Down, of course, is filled with animals. It's more of an allegory. But Richard Adams, who was the author of Watership Down, he wrote a book called Plague Dogs, which if you haven't read, I highly recommend it. It's incredibly painful, but it's incredibly worth reading, I think. It was written by Richard Adams for the express purpose to raise awareness about animals used in laboratories, animals used for testing. And so now here we have three books, one about horses who were being exploited and abused for human use. You have Charlotte's Web about a little girl who saves a pig because she doesn't want to eat him. And of course, many people have become vegetarian from reading Charlotte's Web. And then you have Plague Dogs by the author of Watership Down, which was written for the express purpose of raising awareness about animal testing. Do not underestimate the power of art and the power of literature as a conduit for inspiration and information. And we have many, many more examples of art and literature serving that purpose. Fine literature in its own right, and also a tool for advocacy. So shortly after Angel's discovery of Black Beauty, in 1889, the American Humane Education Society, the organization I said Angel founded, sponsored a writing contest to find its equivalent for dogs, to find a story about the, quote, kind and cruel treatment of domestic animals and birds in the northern states. The prize was $200. A Canadian writer by the name of Margaret Marshall Saunders submitted her work in that same year, and it won. And it was brought to publication in 1893. Now, interestingly, because female authors were not popular at the time, Saunders decided to disguise her sex by not using her first name, Margaret. Instead, she used her middle name, Marshall. And so when the book was published, in 1893, it was said to be authored by Marshall Saunders, and the book was called Beautiful Joe. It was also written from the point of view of the animal main character, and in fact, the original title, the original full title, was Beautiful Joe, an autobiography, not unlike that of Black Beauty. It was dedicated by Margaret Marshall Saunders to George Thorndike Angel, president of the American Humane Education Society, the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and the parent American Band of Mercy. That's what it is written in the original novel. So the writing contest created by the American Humane Education Society was inspired by Black Beauty, and the novel Beautiful Joe was also inspired by Black Beauty. Just as Anna Sewell had called attention to animal abuse, in that case horses, Saunders wanted to do the same. And just as Sewell appears to have modeled her main character, Black Beauty, on a real-life family horse she loved, Saunders, too, based her main character on the abused dog she had met in 1892 when she traveled to an Ontario town called Meaford, M-E-A-F-O-R-D, to visit her brother and his fiancée, Louise Moore. The Moore family had found this abused dog malnourished and bleeding from his ears and tail, all of which had been chopped off with an axe by his former owner. Not only did they take him home and care for him for the rest of his life, they also named him, despite his mutilations, Beautiful Joe. In the novel, the Moores become the Morris family, and the story takes place in a small town in Maine in the U.S., but it's based on a true story of a dog named Beautiful Joe. The book and its subject received worldwide attention, and it was the first Canadian book in history to sell over 1 million copies. In 1902, a sequel, Beautiful Joe's Paradise, was published, but by the late 1930s, the original story, Beautiful Joe, had sold over 7 million copies worldwide. In 1934, at age 73, Margaret was awarded Commander of the Order of the British Empire. At that time, it was Canada's highest civilian honor, and she also received a medal from a society in France. Margaret died at her home in Toronto on February 15th, 1947, and later that same year, she was given the designation of Person of National Historical Significance by the Government of Canada all because she wrote a novel about animal abuse and a surviving victim. In 1963, the official Beautiful Joe Park was named in Meaford in Ontario, next to the Moore House, where Beautiful Joe was loved and rehabilitated by Louise Moore. And then in 1994, the Beautiful Joe Heritage Society was formed to preserve Joe's legacy and ultimately establish the Moore residence as a museum. You can visit the museum. You can visit where Beautiful Joe, the actual Beautiful Joe dog, is buried. And of course, you can visit the house, visit his grave, and all of that can be found at beautifuljoe.org. All of this came out of ordinary citizens like you and me using their wit, their talent, their skills, their gifts, their compassion to help animals. And look at what they accomplished. The work of Henry Berg, starting the ASPCA in New York, inspired George Thorndike Angel, who founded the MSPCA and the AHES and the Band of Mercy. Writers like Anna Sewell inspired readers around the world, including George Thorndike Angel, who leveraged her book by using it as a tool for advocacy and as a means for educating young people on the cruelty of animal abuse and the virtues of compassion. He then inspired Margaret Marshall Saunders to write a book about animal cruelty and kindness, and we still have Beautiful Joe with us today, which I recommend you read. I recommend you read all of these books I mention on this podcast because, as I always say, I think it's so important that as animal advocates, we know whose shoulders we stand on. All of these people, these works, these novels are part of our history, are part of the foundation upon which we build our own work. It's one of the reasons I love the work of the Animals Museum to preserve the history and the consciousness of our human culture. Museum, from the Greek word muse, as in the muses or the arts inspired by these muses. These advocates of yore are my muses, just as they may be yours. And this is our legacy. In fact, another example of this lineage of inspiration and advocacy continued well into the 1900s, and it continues today in Cleveland Amory, an American novelist who's best known for his best-selling books about his adopted cat, Polar Bear. I was working in bookstores at the time. His books were huge bestsellers. I remember when these books came out. Polar Bear was his cat, and he wrote first The Cat Who Came for Christmas in 1987. And the book that followed that was The Cat and the Curmudgeon in 1990. And then The Best Cat Ever in 1993, which was published after Polar Bear's death. All of these books were bestsellers, but it was his work as an animal activist that was most dear to Amory's heart and for which he's equally known. Like for so many of us, and like for Berg and Angel, it was when Amory saw animals being abused that his life completely changed, when he bore witness. He decided to work on behalf of animals upon witnessing a bullfight in Mexico around 1945. This is the power of bearing witness to animal abuse, whether it's live or whether it's a film that we watch or a book that we read. So in 1967, about 100 years after Angel founded the MSPCA, Cleveland Amory founded the Fund for Animals that became very well known in 1979. For sponsoring a removal by air and land of 580 Grand Canyon burros slated for destruction by the National Park Service. I talked about this in my Burden of Burros episode. This was the largest animal rescue ever accomplished, and a very difficult one at that, as you can imagine, with not a single animal hurt. Of course, now that they rescued 580 burros, they needed a new home for all of these animals. And soon after, Amory was able to accomplish a lifelong dream of creating an animal sanctuary for these and other neglected and abused animals. And so he founded a sanctuary he called Black Beauty Ranch. Black Beauty Ranch is located in East Texas, and I had the pleasure of spending some time there about 7 years ago. It is an incredible place. I have many photos and videos you can see on my website on today's page for today's episode, and it was absolutely beautiful. It's a 1,400 plus acre sanctuary that Amory had always wanted to open, and he was inspired by Anna Sewell's novel, Black Beauty. It's a sanctuary that shelters many abused animals, including chimpanzees, burros, elephants, many non-human primates. One of Black Beauty's most famous residents was a 25-year-old chimp named Nim Chimpsky, who had been used in language experiments when he was young and then sold as a laboratory animal. And if you've read the book Nim Chimpsky, The Chimp Who Would Be Human, or saw the documentary film Project Nim, you'll know his story. And on that thread, I certainly can't name all of the novels and films that were inspired by some form of animal use or abuse. But on this thread, without saying too much, I want to recommend another novel. It's a contemporary novel that I read not long ago and was completely blown away by. It's called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, a novel written by Karen Joy Fowler. I will say no more, but I encourage you to just take my word for it, not read anything about it. Don't read the reviews of the book. Just read the book, We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, and tell me what you think. So this sanctuary became the home to many animals, chimpanzees, non-human primates, elephants, burros, and of course, horses. Now, usually when we see horses, they're all bound up with buckles and harnesses and saddles and cinches and such. And I have to say, it was surreal. One of the things that left such an impression on me after visiting Black Beauty was to see horses just wandering and walking and bonding and playing and running through the woods, like running through the forest. Like, when's the last time you saw free horses running through the forest and all over these hills and acres of grassland? It was just incredible. Black Beauty is currently operated by the Humane Society of the United States at this point, and they have open days where you can go visit and tour the sanctuary. So I encourage you to do so if you're able to, and certainly support their work. But here again, we have this thread. Cleveland Amory, a novelist himself, writing books like The Cat Who Came for Christmas, inspired by his cat, he opens a sanctuary called Black Beauty, inspired by Anna Sewell's novel. And indeed, on the ranch's gate are the words from the final lines of Sewell's novel. They say, "I have nothing to fear, and my story ends. My troubles are all over, and I am at home." Those are the words on the gate of Black Beauty Ranch. You can read all about the Grand Canyon Burro Rescue and the founding of Black Beauty in Amory's 1997 book called Ranch of Dreams, in which he wrote, "It was not long after reading Black Beauty for the first time that I had a dream that one day I would have a place that would embody everything Black Beauty loved about his final home. I dreamed that I would go even a step further. At my place, none of the horses would ever wear a bit or blinkers or check reins, or in fact have reins at all, because they would never pull a cart, a carriage, a cab, or anything else. Indeed, they would never even be ridden. They would just run free." So you can see photos and videos. I also have photos on my website for today's episode of a very special memorial that David and I happened upon when we were visiting Cambridge and Boston several years ago. One of the places we like to go when we're traveling is cemeteries, which may sound strange, but we find cemeteries very beautiful and peaceful. And certainly most large cities who have cemeteries also have historic figures buried there. And so one day, about 10 years ago, we went to Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, which is, I'm sure you have heard of it, is it absolutely beautiful, and in whom is buried many notables and many people who are not known, of course, and it is just as valid for them. But there are such notables there as architect Buckminster Fuller, a hospital reformer and advocate for the mentally ill Dorothea Dix, author Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., activist, poet, and author of Battle Hymn Republic, Julia Ward, and bringing us full circle, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and George Thorndike Angell. In fact, George Thorndike Angell, even though on his biography page on Wikipedia said that he's buried at Mount Auburn Cemetery, when you click on Mount Auburn Cemetery's listing of notable people buried there on Wikipedia, he wasn't there. He's there now. And I encourage you to do this kind of mini activism as you're able to, because again, this is part of our legacy and he needs to be listed there. I don't know if you remember the episode I did on our visit to Rwanda, in which I talk about the work of one of my heroes and primatologist, animal advocate Diane Fossey. When I was doing the research for that episode, I discovered that she wasn't listed on the Wikipedia page as a notable person from San Francisco, and I changed that too. There's little tiny bits of advocacy that help cement animal advocates in the public consciousness because they are part of our human legacy. They're part of our human history. They're part of our human culture, and they should be remembered and celebrated. And I'm pleased to say that George Thorndike Angel is indeed celebrated for his work for animals in many ways, and we saw that when we happened upon his grave by accident in Mount Auburn Cemetery. At the time, I didn't know he was buried there. We weren't even looking for it. It's massive, and when you see it, you'll be like, well, how did you almost miss it? It's a massive memorial, but it's a huge cemetery, so we just weren't looking for it, but it was such a gift to happen upon it. It's a beautiful memorial to his work for animals, which is his legacy. He lived from 1823 to 1909 and noted on the massive stone sculpture, along with a five-pointed badge that was the MSPCA's original logo. It says, Band of Mercy, Glory to God, Kindness, Justice, Mercy to All. And it's capped with the inscription, Blessed are the Merciful. And at its base is inscribed, We must never forget that the infinitely most important work for us is the humane education of the millions who are soon to come on the stage of actions. George Thorndike Angel. There's also a massive monument to Angel in Boston in the Financial District in Post Office Square. And I include a photo of that on today's website page, designed by Peabody and Stearns in the early 20th century. It's decorated with lion's heads and a gilded eagle atop a flagpole. The Angel Monument originally served as a water fountain for carriage horses, and it bears the inscription, Our humane societies are now sowing the seed of a harvest, which will one of these days protect not only the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, but also human beings as well. May you reap what others have sown and sow your own seeds yourself. Find your voice, use your voice, use your passion, use your skills, use your gifts, write books, make films, make art, start an organization, start a revolution in the name of compassion for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.